Okay, we're holding at the top of Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph, continuing on with the series of Mishnayos talking about, like we started yesterday, when you make a neder, which includes some definition, what's included in that definition and what isn't.
Lamed Aleph.
Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph, the top.
Did we finish?
Finished, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Mishnah says, Hanodu Mishovs to Shabbos, somebody who makes a neder not to have Hanah from people who keep Shabbos, also be Yisrael, but also be Kusim. So he's not allowed to have Hanah from regular Jews, but also not from the Kusim. The Kusim we've talked about before, they're the colonists, the Tancherev, and his successors brought to repopulate the land of the Ten Shvatim. The Pasuk mentions that they started keeping the mitzvahs, but they also continued worshipping their various gods. During the whole time of the second Mishmikdash, there's a machlokas. Are they basically gay? We learned about this especially in Yevamos. Are they basically gayri aroyas? Are they basically only became gayrim because of fear of the lions that were attacking them, and therefore they never really became true gayrim in the first place? Or are they gayri ms? Are they true gayrim who actually accepted Yiddishkeit fully? Whatever it is, during the time of the second Mishmikdash, there were various dinim in which they were careful, and various other ones in which they weren't. To some extent, their ideas were similar to the tzedukim. For example, they only believed in Teresh B'Chsav and not really in Teresh B'Alpeh. Later on, towards the end of the time of the Mishnah, they found they were actually worshiping idols. They found they had an image of a dove that they were bowing down to on Har Gerizim, their sanctuary, and therefore they declared them goyim gemurim. Although even then, the Yerushalmi mentions that even then you were still allowed to drink their wine until 100 odd years later, when one of the Roman emperors at that point issued a gzera that all nations in his kingdom have to pour out libations, nesachim, in his honor as a god. Except he exempted the Jewish people, knowing that they're not going to do it. Yeah, nice guy, Diocletianus, Diocletian, is called in English. The Kusim didn't take advantage of that of that exemption. They went and they want to show we're loyal to the emperor. We will go. So therefore, at that point, their wine became Yain Netzachim. Anyway, the point is that the point is then that Kusim do keep Shabbos. Therefore, when you say Mishovs to Shabbos, then it includes them as well. Ma'ochlishum, or no, so that's the thing. So if we say the Gemara is going to discuss the idea that they're mitzvah v'oisa, that they're commanded in keeping Shabbos, and they do it. Again, remember when we're talking during the time of the Mishnah. During most of the time of the Mishnah, you have this machlokas whether they're geiri aroyas or geiri emes. Obviously, our Mishnah must be going according to the opinion that they're geiri emes. Because otherwise, the Gemara's point about them being commanded to keep Shabbos wouldn't work. Yeah. What if somebody says a neder that I'm not going to have hana from people who eat garlic? Now, it doesn't just mean some people who eat garlic. Lots of people eat garlic. It means people who have a particular reason to eat garlic, in particular on Erev Shabbos. Later on, in the Masechta, it mentions, in Bava Kamma, it actually mentions that it was one of the 10 takanot of Ezra, that Jews should eat garlic on Fridays, on Friday night, whatever, because we talked about it a week or two ago, that garlic increases the person, increases taiva, it increases the ability. And since Friday night is supposed to be the time for Ona, the particular time for Ona, especially for Tamina Chachamim, so Ezra made this takana that they should eat garlic. So someone who makes this neder that he won't have hana from people who eat garlic, also be Yisrael, but also be Kusim. Also, he's also in regular Jews because they follow this. And he's also in Kusim because he's also in Kusim. Now, here actually there's different girsahs. The girsah that we have over here is that it includes the Kusim as well. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, how? I mean, this is a Takanas Ezra. The Kusim don't hold with that. By the time Ezra came along, the beginning of the second Mishmikdash, the Kusim are outright enemies of the regular Jews. So some Mefarshim say that yes, it's true they're not technically bound by that takana. Tosfos says that just as a practical matter they realize it is a good takana. It is a good takana, we might as well. So they're not doing it specifically because Ezra said to do it, but still they are keeping it for that same reason. Having said that, though, it was an interesting thing. The Evan Ezra brings. That Ben Ezra brings from Reb Sadia Goren, that actually the Karoyim in their time, who took it from Kusim earlier, they actually held you're not supposed to have relations on Shabbos. they claim based on various psukim, either b'chorish or b'chotzer tishbois, that they claim that chorish means plowing as a euphemism for having relations, or because of loisavaru esh, like don't kindle the flames of passion, whatever it is. So they may have actually held that you don't have relations on Shabbos. In that case, what are they doing? Eating garlic. So there is, as a matter of fact, the Beis Yosef brings on Shulchan Aruch, there is a girsa that says also be Yisrael mutter b'kusim, that you would be allowed to have anah from kusim if you make this neder about not eating earthly shum, because precisely that the kusim, either because they don't hold a takanas Ezra b'chlal, or because they never accepted any takanas of Ezra at all, they were already open enemies of the Jewish people at that point, or because even if they might have felt that, you know what, it's a useful thing, shroom does, garlic does increase taiva, etc., they certainly wouldn't do it Friday night if they're holding that you can't have relations on Shabbos. So therefore, you have that here, some mutter b'kusim. The problem with that is that the Gemara goes on to say that there are various cases in Mishnah we're talking about where they're mitzvah v'oisa. They're commanded to do something and they actually do it.
Opposition is what?
What?
The halacha.
So the halacha, I mean, you have the two possibilities. The tour brings the girsa as we have it, that you would in fact be also to have anah from the kusim. They're considered earthly shum as well. But Beis Yosef mentions this girsa that mutter b'kusim. The Rambam, by the way, doesn't bring this whole concept at all. Not as far as this din of what happens with the neder of earthly shum. And klal, the Rambam doesn't even bring the whole idea of eating garlic on Shabbos, on Friday or on Friday night or whatever. And various Mephoshim talk about
it's not possible to eat the...
Not possible, but the Rambam B'chlal doesn't bring this concept that there's an Indian to eat garlic on Erev Shabbos or on Friday night. And various Mephoshim say, based on, as the Rambam himself writes later on in the Masechta, when we have another discussion about this business of garlic on Friday night, the Rambam uses the expression there in Pirush HaMishnayot that in those climates and in those times, it was good for them to eat garlic to increase their tiger, etc. So the implication is it's not an absolute thing that you must eat garlic on Erev Shabbos. It's a situational thing. If you live in a climate and then you have a certain body type where eating shum helps with your tiger, then good. If not, then not. So therefore, the Rambam B'chlal doesn't mention this whole concept because earthly shum doesn't necessarily have that same meaning in other times and places.
It brings you to Peru or food.
But it not necessarily does it to everybody. No. I mean, that's the point. As a matter of fact, the Rambam writes in Hilchot Deis that it's bad to eat garlic during, I forget whether the Rambam says that it's bad to eat garlic altogether or just during some times of the year, but whatever it is, evidently the Rambam holds that the Takanas Ezra wasn't meant as an absolute thing, you must eat garlic. It's rather, if garlic helps, if you're in a time and place where garlic helps, then you should be doing that. Another one, the Mishnah says, over your shalayim, if somebody makes a neder that I won't have enough and people will go up to your shalayim, then there's a difference. Also be strolled and mutter b'kusim. Then he's also to have enough from regular Jews, but he is allowed to have enough from the kusim because the kusim don't hold of going to your shalayim. The kusim hold, and in fact, in various places in their version of the Torah, it actually holds the places where it talks about hamokam asher yivchar Hashem, and Chumash never mentions the name Yerushalayim. The name Yerushalayim is not mentioned until Sefer Yeshua. But in all those places where it talks about hamokam asher yivchar Hashem, the kusim put into their Torah that it's talking about how grizzly the mountain over there near Shem where they had their temple. But they held that is the proper place. They go there and they bring their quote unquote coat and Pesach and whatever and they do their rituals over there. No, that's the thing. So they don't hold of going to Yerushalayim. Therefore, you can't call them over Yerushalayim. Yeah, there's a famous story that we learned in Yuma about when Alexander the Great conquered Eretz Yisrael and the Kusim tried to convince him that the Jews are rebelling against you and you should destroy the Beis Hamikdash. And the upshot of it is that Shimon HaTzadik came to Alexander and told him that Abed Abed be davening for your success and they got permission to go and destroy the sanctuary of the Kusim on Hagrizim. But later on they rebuilt it. But whatever, Hagrizim was their holy place. Was, still is their holy place, yeah. So Gemara asks, "My shows to Shabbos. What do we mean in the Mishnah? People who rest on Shabbos. Ilemim mekayme Shabbos. Do we just mean anybody who actually observes Shabbos? My yiri b'kusim. Then what are you mentioning? The Mishnah is only mentioning regular Jews in kusim, which would seem to imply that goyim you are allowed to have anah from. But after the ojikachavim nami, but there were even actual outright goyim who keep Shabbos. an interesting sociological detail that you have there, that there were goyim in those days, full-fledged goyim, but they considered Shabbos an important thing and they kept it. Maybe that's why the Gemara has to stress in Sanhedrin, Akum Shashabbos, Chayiv Misa, because it may have been a very common thing. With Midi Shemayim, sure, but yeah. The point remains, though, that if you just mean if Shov say Shabbos means people who actually in practice rest on Shabbos, whether they have a mitzvah to or not, then that would include goyim. Certain goyim. Elamim mitzvim al Shabbos. So no, you're going to have to say that it means people who are commanded to keep Shabbos. In that case, ihochi emaseif. No, well, then look at the last part of the Mishnah. May early Yerushalayim also be Yisrael amutzer b'kosim. You say the Mishnah that if you make a neder not to have enough from people who go up to Yerushalayim, then it only includes regular Jews but not kosim. Why? The Kusim have just as much of a mitzvah of Aliyah the Regal as regular Jews, again, according to the opinion that they're Geirei Emes, that they're true Geirim, then they have a mitzvah of Aliyah the Regal to the real Beis Mikdash, not to the fake one on Hagarism, just like any Jew. The fact that they don't, the fact that they hate Yerushalayim and want to see it destroyed is neither here nor there. We're talking before they made, right. Obviously, once they declare them going Gmurim, there's nothing to talk about anymore, yeah. We're talking about during the period when they had the machlokas, whether they're Geirei Arayis or Geirei Emes. But if you say they're Geirei Emes, then they have a mitzvah. Then they have a mitzvah to come to Yerushalayim just like everybody else. Yeah. Amar Abaye mitzvah va'oisa katani. No, what the Mishnah is actually talking about is in these cases is somebody who has a mitzvah to do one of these things and who actually does it. So, v'tarti bavi kamaisa, so in the first two parts of the Mishnah, Yisrael v'kosim v'tzuvim v'oisim, the regular Jews in the Kosim have a commandment to rest on Shabbos and to eat garlic from Takanas Ezra, whereas ov d'kachavim ahu da'av v'oisim ben mitzuvim. Whereas any goyim who do in practice keep Shabbos, they may be keeping it, but they don't have a mitzvah to. Therefore, they're not included. But early Yerushalayim, whereas when it comes to early Yerushalayim, Yisrael Mitzvah Moisin, regular Jews have a mitzvah to go to Yerushalayim and they actually do it. Kusim, Mitzvah Vein Moisin, the Kusim have the mitzvah, if they're Geirei Emes, but they don't in practice do it, so therefore they can't be included in that category. That's the point. Then they're not included. Therefore, when you say early Yerushalayim, you're not including the Kusim, because when you say about any of these things, you're talking about it has to be people who have a mitzvah to do it and who actually do it. So as far as early Yerushalayim, we're not really getting into it, but later on Amud Beis, when we talk about Arelim versus Mulim, there is Machlokas Rishonim, whether when we say over there in on Amud Beis, we'll have a Mishnah that says there that you make a neder from Arelim, it means only Goyim but not Jews, and Mulim means only Jews, not Goyim. Yeah, there's a Machlokas Rishonim what kind of case of an oral Jew we're talking about. Are we talking about where he's unable to do Mila because, you know, he's hemophilia or whatever, Meserach of Masas Mila, or does it also include case where he just doesn't want to have a bris milah because of the pain or whatever, or is it only when he's a mumur la relis, when he's a bedavka, he refuses to do the mitzvah, whatever. So I guess you could have a similar machlokas over here. If you have a Jew who doesn't go to Yerushalayim for one reason or another, would he be included or not? The difference might be that we learned back in Chagiga earlier this year that there's various categories of Jews who are potter from Aliyah the Regel. There really aren't any male Jews who are potter from Bris Milah except from Beis Rachel Machas Milah, and even that is more of an onus than anything else.
The ones that are potter from the Regel,
somebody who can't walk on his two feet, right. You know, whatever. Somebody doesn't have property, yeah. Next Mishnah, Koinam She'eni Nen Elev Bnei Noach. Somebody says a Koinam that I will not have Hana from Bnei Noach. Mutav Yisrael, he's still allowed to have Hana from Jews, but also the Kachavim, he's only also in the Goyim. Now, the Jewish people are descended from Noach as well. Everybody in the world is descended from Noach. But, so the Gemara asks, V'Yisrael mi Nafik V'Kal Bnei Noach. What do you mean? Doesn't the word Bnei Noach, doesn't that term include everybody, including the Jewish people? And the answer is no. Kiven D'Ikdash Avraham, once Avraham was declared holy, Once he became a separate thing, Iskiru al Shmei. From then on, the Jewish people are called after his name. No, I mean, for certain technical purposes, we do say, and we'll talk about it later on when we talk about Moshe Rabbeinu and the matter of the Bris Milah of his son, until Matan Torah, the Jewish people are included in Bnei Noach. But our Mishnah is talking about after Matan Torah, obviously. That's when the Dinim and the Jodim start taking effect. So, sort of retroactively to the fact that Avraham is the first Jew, so that's the thing. When we talk about who's the first Jew, is it Avraham or is it all the Jewish people on Mount Torah? There's in a way a little bit of both. But the point is, once Abraham comes along, then his specific descendants that we'll talk about in the Gemara on the next Mishnah, namely the Jewish people, are not considered Bnei Noach anymore. Eventually comes Mount Torah and they actually become a new Metzius of their own, the Jewish people. Yeah. But the point is, at that point, they're not considered Bnei Noach. They're not called after Noach's name anymore. They're called, we Jewish people come we do come biologically from Noach, but not, that's not what we're considered anymore. We're a new concept. We're Bnei Abraham. Next Mishnah says, She'eni nein lezera Abraham. What if somebody says that I will not have Hana from the seed of Abraham? And by the way, this that we say over here, She'eni Nene, in these Mishnayos, they talk about that maybe the correct use should be She'ani Nene, because we've talked about before, a neder really is supposed to be on the Chefta, not on the Gavra. So it would have to be any object of Bnei Noach or Zera Avraham, as the case may be, that I'm also to have Hana from it. That it's also for me to have Hana from, rather. So it would be She'ani Nene, not She'eni Nene, because that would be more of a Shavua. Okay. Anyway. So She'eni Nene Lezer Avram, also be Yisrael, then he's also to have Hanah from any Jews, but he's allowed to have Hanah from Goyim. Okay, my ask, what do you mean? Zer Avram includes some Goyim as well. Ba'ika Yishmael, isn't there the Yishmael and his descendants are children of Avram? The answer is no. The Pasuk says, Ki b'Yitzchak Yikarel Chazorak. No, the Pasuk says that only in Yitzchak is called your seed. So Yishmael is not considered the seed of Avram. We'll get to that in a second. But Ike Esav, okay, what about in the next generation you have Esav? And the answer is Bi Yitzchak V'Lai Kol Yitzchak. There's still, since the passage says, it doesn't say Ki Yitzchak Yikarel Chazara, but Bi Yitzchak, that implies that even within Yitzchak himself, there's a differentiation. And what's that differentiation? Yaakov versus Esav. Rambam gives a logical svara for it, because who's considered the Zera Avraham, the ones who went through what it describes in the British Ben Absarim, Yodaya Teda Kigeri Yezaracha Berif Lelahem, Ba'avadrim, etc., and who went through that, with today's Chumash with Rashi, Moshe Rabbeinu's embassy to Melech Edom, and we went through all of that, now we're finally coming to our land, let us pass through. So you see then that only Bnei Yaakov are considered the true descendants of Avraham. So you're asking, what about Gerim? So Many Rishonim say that indeed Gerim are included as well, for the reason that the Rambam describes in connection with the halachas of Bikurim and various other halachas because Avraham is effectively the first Ger, he's the first one to recognize the Eved Shter. Therefore, all future Gerim are called after his name. They can all be called Bnei Avraham. Having said that, though, the ritual brings that maybe there might be a difference whether he says Bnei Avraham or Zera Avraham. Bnei Avraham might well include Gerim, but Zera Avraham arguably would include only born Jews.
Nothing says that Esav is not the Zera of Avraham.
No, that's the thing. But we're saying, well, we're darshaning from Kibi Yitzchak. Right. It's an interesting thing, by the way, I saw from Yitzchak Kutner. He says, if you look sociologically, if you look at how things are in recent generations, you have the Arabs, the descendants of Yishmael, more or less, they're always trying to assert their rulership over Eretz Yisrael. The Christians who are biologically or sociologically or whatever descended from Esav, not so much. They consider it a holy land, etc. But they're not so big on we have to own it. He says, what's the difference? Because it's based on this over here. Yishmael was never given part of Abraham's Yerusha. The Torah actually says in so many words that Yishmael is out. Therefore, he's jealous. Therefore, he wants that Yerusha. Esav got a Yerusha after all. Esav got his real Yerusha. How say? Therefore, he's not so hot to possess Eretz Yisrael. Whereas Yishmael not. He says also. Another interesting detail. He says if you look at it, the Christians took over our Tanakh and they consider it a holy book to them also. The Muslims not. There's an interesting truth of the Rambam about the difference in that regard between teaching a Christian Torah versus teaching a Muslim Torah. Anyway, Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner says on that, it's similar to this idea. Where do we see that Yishmael is not considered the descendant of Abraham from what it actually says in the Pasuk? Therefore, what Nishtalshul from, because it actually says, Kibi Yitzchak Yitzchak Yitzchak, meaning not Yishmael. Therefore, they threw away the whole Tanakh, because they're not interested in it. Whereas the Christians, they believe in Torah Shabbat, they don't believe in Torah Shabbat. Why? Because the fact that they were excluded, we only know from Torah Shabbat, from the days of Kibi Yitzchak, from the Drasha. Therefore, that's what they threw away in their Torah Shabbat.
Yeah, but
that's
what I'm saying.
Okay, I mean, we're not necessarily talking biological descent. I mean, when we say Christians and Esav, we're not necessarily talking that, you know, the billion or whatever it is Christians in the world are all literally descended from Esav. Obviously not. But we mean spiritually, we mean culturally, religiously, etc. Yeah. I don't call the whole question when we say that the Romans are descended from Esav, that itself. Do we mean that the whole Roman people are descended from Esav, or do we just mean that their, you know, their original leaders, their founders, their patricians or whatever maybe are descended from Esav and everybody else is descended from various other nations? Whatever. Okay. Okay. Mishnah says, She'eni Nen El Yisrael, what if somebody says in Neder that I will not have Hana from Jews? Well then, in order not to have hana, if he's buying from a Jew, he has to buy at a higher price. That way he's not having hana in the fact that he's buying. And when it comes to selling, if he's selling something to another Jew, he has to sell it for cheaper. So he's losing money on the deal, and that way he's not having hana. How about the other way around? She's thrown men in. What if he
doesn't want them?
No, or he has to do business with somebody. I mean, the end of the mission is going to say that if he made a bilateral neder that he can't have enough from them or them from him, then he has no choice but to do business with goyim. But like this, he's only made himself also to have enough from Jews. He can still do business with them, but he's going to have to make sure to lose money on the deal every time. How about the other way around? She's still menningly. What if he makes the neder that other Jews are not allowed to have enough from me? Well, he still wants to be able to buy and sell. So then if it comes to buying, he'll have to buy at a cheaper price in order that the moicher doesn't have hana. When it comes to selling, he'll have to sell at a higher price. They ain't shaming, but they're not going to listen to him. Who's gonna tell him? He's going to come to them, I made a neder, I can't have hana from you, therefore I want to buy something from you, give it to me for a discount. Tough luck, you got yourself in that situation. And the Ran brings another gusa that it says on the side over here also, that's not v'ein shomim lo, but im shomim lo. Fine, if he can find somebody who's willing to go along with that, then fine, gusun to hate, let him be able to do that. Realistically, he's probably not going to be able to.
Even though the mocha is getting money, you think it's not hard, but the fact
that's, we're going to discuss that in the Gemara, the various possibilities, what kind of goods are we talking about. Well, the Tiferes Yisrael says an interesting idea. He says that this business about lekeach v'pachos and mocha b'yoser im shomim lo, what the Mishnah is telling us is, normally you would think, forget about the whole issue of the neder, wouldn't there be an issue of einah over there, that you're not allowed to overcharge, or you're not allowed to overcharge for what you're selling, and you're not allowed to underbuy. But he says, in this case, because the person is bound by this neder, therefore he may not have a choice, so therefore, We'll allow him to do that. Or no, if he can find somebody who's willing to go along with that, then yes, we'll waive the situation with Hinnah. How about Shaini Nen Lahen Behainli? What if he says a bilateral neder? I won't have any Hinnah from Jews, and they won't have any Hinnah from me. Well, then Yehonaloi B'Kachavim. Then all he can do is have Hinnah from Goyim. Now the Ram says, so what's the chiddush in that part? So what's the chiddush in that part? So the Ran brings from the Ra'ah, the chiddush is, you might think, if he made such a neder, then that's an impossible to fulfill neder. So the same way as we learned before, that for example, a person makes a shavua, that I won't sleep for a week, then you, 3 days, whatever, you give him malchus for a shavua shav, and then give him to Haiti, he can sleep right away. You would think maybe over here this is an impossible neder. No, it's not impossible, because he can still find, maybe he lives in a place that's all Jews, fine, he'll have to travel a little bit, but he can find some place where there's goyim and do business with them. No, when we say all the mentions of Ovi Kachavim means Mishnah, it means Goyim in general, it's the chain of rather sense. The Ran points out, by the way, in this connection, when we're saying over here that there's still the possibility he made a neder not to have hana from Jews, or for Jews not to have hana from him, and yet we're saying they're able to buy and sell just at different prices than usual, that's because if he made the neder on them. But if he made the neder on their nechassim, then that's a different matter. Then you can't buy from them no matter what the price is, or sell to them no matter what the price is, because the fact is, it is their nechassim, or his nechassim, as the case may be. The Gemara says, The Gemara is going to kind of go again on a sort of side topic and then connect that with our Mishnah. If somebody takes a keli from the craftsman in order to check it out, so he there's something that the craftsman is selling, he wants to take it home, decide whether it's good or whatever, and if it's good, then he'll come back and pay for it. And an onus happened while it was in his hand, then he's chayav to pay the seller. Which goes to show then that he holds that the why is he chayiv an oinsin? Now at this, the point is we consider him like a shoyl. We consider him like a borrower. A borrower, the din is, we say, kol hanashalah. A borrower has all of the advantages and none of the disadvantages, because unlike a shoyl mechinam, he's not obligated to. A shoyl mechinam has all of the disadvantages and none of the advantages, because he's not getting paid for his time and he can't use the thing. A shoyl mesachar is sort of balanced, because on the one hand, he can't use it, but on the other hand, he's getting paid. A shoyl is the opposite of a shoyl mechinam. He has all the benefits, because he can use it, and none of the disadvantages, because he's not getting paid. Therefore, he's chayiv in everything, including oinsin. The only thing he's potter from is based on machmas malacha. This person who took this keli home to check it out is considered a shoyl. So there, and if we consider him a shoyl, what are we saying? We're saying that the lekeach has the hana, has all the hana. So he's just like a shoyl. That's why he's chayiv and everything. That's the thing. We consider him like a shoyl. Now the Gemara points out, and the Ran points out, but the Gemara points out in Bava Basra, where it discusses this whole issue, that we have to be talking about a case where the purchase price of the thing is fixed. We're not talking about where there's still bargaining to be done on the price. The point is, therefore, that the buyer knows all I have to. It's all dependent on me. If I like this thing, then all I have to do is come back to the store and give money. I don't know if it's still bargain. So therefore, at that point, we consider effectively kol hanah shaloi. We consider at that point all the hanah is his, because everything is now on his side. He's the one to decide whether it's good, and he's the one who has to pay. Rashi over here puts it somewhat differently, that because he has more, it does, according to Rashi, it would seem it doesn't even have to be a fixed price. He has more hana, the fact that he's able to take it home and decide whether to buy it or not. Therefore, he's willing to be meshabed himself. He's willing to be considered fine. I'm willing to be considered a shoyl and to be chayiv and everything.
That's it.
Okay, so we see the point is either way we explain it. We see that the hana is all on the lekeach side. Now let's consider how that fits with our Mishnah. Tznan she'eni nanim Yisrael. Our Mishnah had said, if he said, I'm not going to have hana from Jews, moicha b'pachos, then if he's going to sell something to them, he has to sell them at a discount, so he doesn't lose money, so he loses money on it, which implies avav v'shava v'shava lai. But he can't sell something for the exact price that it should really fetch in the market in normal circumstances. Now, the ihanas lekeach, shava v'shava means something that's worth $1.
He sells it for 50.
No, yeah, something that's worth 50, he's selling it for 50. That's shava v'shava. Why? The ihanas lekeach. If you say the hana is on the lekeach side, after the shava v'shava, then what's the problem? He said he's not going to have hana from other Jews. So fine, if he were to take something that's worth 50 and sell it for 51 or whatever, so it's less than hana, then fine, he's having hana. But if he sells it for exactly 50, according to what Shmuel is saying, it's only the lekeach has hana. So then what's the problem? No. The answer is, Masnissin bezvina de romi al hape. Our Mishnah is talking about an object for sale that it's like sitting on his face. Meaning something that you're having a very hard time selling. So Rashi explains the figure of speech. It's like you're so sick of this thing. It's like it's sitting on your face and you want to get rid of it. The point is that then if you have something like that, then yes, even selling it for the actual price that it would normally fetch is considered a hana.
Because you want to get rid of it.
No, not at any price. You still want to be able to get the fair price for it, but it's something that doesn't sell easily. It's something it has a certain defined value. The Gemara's view of economics is a little bit different than the present day one. You know, nowadays they usually, you know, the prices of things they usually think of in terms of supply and demand. If there's no demand for something, then the price of it is effectively zero. The Gemara's view of economics, the economic system they had in those times, is more like a thing has a certain fixed value. Abed, in various places, the Gemara talks about, like, again, different than the assumptions of economics nowadays, that the value of goods is fixed. It's the value of money that varies. I mean, nowadays, it's more the other way around. So the value of money is considered the standard against which everything else is measured. So, yeah, it is.
Money changes all the time.
But that's when they do the consumer price index or whatever, they adjust it for inflation because, you know, they're fine. They're accepting the fact that money gradually changes in value. But basically, at any given time, they're using a dollar as or whatever currency unit as the measure of things.
No, okay. They use an index.
Okay, whatever. That's fine. This is not time for a discussion. Okay, fine. No, not for discussion on economics. Okay, fine. They don't use code. Okay, whatever. They use the
money.
Okay, whatever. New.
More sophisticated.
New. Okay, whatever. Fine. So forget what I just said. The point is that the Gemara is taking the view that this object does have an actual defined value. So no, if it's Romi Alape, if the person ends up selling at a loss, he's still not getting Hana because he could have gotten the full value for it. But he's having a hard time selling it. He's having a hard time finding a buyer for it, and therefore, if he manages to sell it for the exact price, for the exact sticker price, then yes, he's getting Hana. Right. The Gemara says in Kain Emer Reisha. Well, if that's the case, then what about the first part of the Mishnah? It said So what about the first part of the Mishnah that said that when it comes to buying, he has to buy at an inflated price? If we're talking about something that's difficult to sell, then when he buys it from the other person, there's Hana. Forget that. Actually, Lekeach v'yoseh, no matter what, if we said according to Shmuel that the Lekeach has Hana, when he buys, regardless of what price he buys it at, he's having Hana. So that's what Shmuel had said. But Oid Ema Sefer, and not only that, look at the last part of the Mishnah, Sheisrael Neninli, the middle part of the Mishnah, that is, that if he said that Jews should not have Hana from me, Lekeach v'pachos v'mocha v'yoseh, when it comes to buying, he buys at a cheaper value. When it comes to selling, he sells at an inflated value. Now again, if we're talking about something that's difficult to find a buyer for, after the shove it, then again, selling it for the exact price would be considered that they're having Hana from him. Well, my answer is safer bizvina charifa. Fine, you can say that the second case of the Mishnah is talking not about, they're talking the opposite, not something where it's hard to find buyers for, something that's flying off the shelf, something that's easy to find buyers for. So if he sells at the actual regular price, then the Lekeach would be having Hana, and he said they can't. Only if he sells at an inflated price, then they're not having that Hana. Okay, then the question is, so then why does he have to buy at cheaper prices? Even if he buys at the exact same price, he's having the Hana, they're not. The Ran points out, I mean, the Gemara knows very well that none of these possibilities really work out. It's going through for argument's sake, in order to clarify the various dinim involved. We should say then that our Mishnah is talking about an average kind of sale item. So it's not something that's flying off the shelves, but on the other hand, it's not something that's sitting there collecting dust for years and nobody's buying. We're talking about an average kind of thing. You can find buyers for it, but, you know, it's. So then,
it's intermediate.
So then if you buy or sell for the exact sticker price, then you have there's a Hana, then the seller is having a Hana, and the buyer is having a Hana, depending on the circumstances. Whereas if it's a slow seller, then the mocher is having a Hana, even if it was at list price, and if it's a fast seller, then the lekeach is having a Hana. Or the Shmuel, there's been a charifa. So Shmuel is talking about a fast seller, something that sells fast. And since, as Iran said, also it has a fixed price, so therefore the Lekeach has the better end of the deal over here. He knows the price of the thing is fixed, and it's something that flies off the shelves really fast. So I have the advantage now that I'm able to take it home and check it out and decide whether I want to buy it. That's considered the Hana of the Lekeach. Tanya Kavasei to Shmuel. In fact, we learn a brisa that goes according to what Shmuel says. If somebody takes kelim from a merchant to send them to his father-in-law's house. So he's engaged. He wants to send presents to his kala and to her family. So, but he buys them on he buys them sort of on spec. Not I'm definitively buying them, but I'm gonna take them. I'm gonna send them to them. See if they like them, and if not, then I have the option still to return them.
Fine.
Speculation, whatever you want to call it. But Omaloi, so he tells him, "Im kablan oisin imeni, if they accept them from me as good wedding pre-wedding presents, and in oisin lachadimeim, then I'll pay you their full value. V'im lav, and if not, and in oisin lachalafitovas hanashibehen, then I won't give you the full price because I'm returning them to you, but I'll pay you for the fact that you allowed me this favor to take them and to take them on consignment like that. That's called tovas hanah." So then, the din is, nensu b'halicha chayiv, so if an oinus to that happened to them while he's taking them, while they're being brought to the father-in-law's house, chayiv, then he would be chayiv, even in the oinusin, because then again, he's considered like a shoyel, because he has all the hana at that point, which agrees with what Shmuel said. B'chazorah potter, whereas when it comes on the way back, then he would be potter for oinus, because at that point, he's not considered a shoyel anymore. Why? Because the thing is like this. When he's taking them to his father-in-law's house, so we're saying he has still the right to buy them at that point. When he's bringing them back, when they decided they didn't like them, and therefore he's bringing them back, it's the equivalent of him having told the storekeeper in the first place that I'm borrowing this object for a certain amount of time. And the din is, once that certain amount of time is over, even the shoyel has not returned the object yet, at that point, he gets converted from a shoyel into a shomer sachar. Why? He's not a shoyel anymore because at that point he has no more right to use it. So like this also, once his father-in-law rejected it, then he has no more right to do anything with it, therefore he can't be considered a shoyel. Why is he considered a shomer sachar? The Gemara explains in Bava Metzia, because since the other guy did him a favor and allowed him to take the thing home and check it out or to bring it to his father-in-law's house or whatever, then therefore he owes the other guy a favor in the future.
Does he have to inform when he makes that decision? Or the other one?
The fact that he's coming back with it.
The fact that he's on his way back. But
yeah, but if something happens, the owner of that thing would like to know it, because maybe...
So he'll have to inform him as soon as possible, sure. But the point is that, no, so if we consider him a shoyel, then he has to pay. If we consider him a shomer sachar, what he actually has to do is, if the storekeeper will take him to Beis Din, and he will have to swear that there was an onus, and not one of the things for which a shomer sachar is chayav. A shomer sachar is chayav if the thing got stolen not as in a holder. That would be considered more an onus, but like stolen would be like somebody snatched it out of his pocket or something, where they should have been more careful with it.
Any time during his possession?
No, again, there's a difference between he's taking it to his father-in-law's house and when he's returning it. When he's taking it to the father-in-law's house, he's considered a shoyel. He's responsible for everything,
right,
including onusin.
Right, but if the onusin happens on the way
back, then he's downgraded to a shomer sachar. So then what happens is he will have to swear in Beis Din that it was an onus, and then he'll be potter. Now that's why is he a shomer sachar, because since the other guy did him a favor, and now he owes the other guy a favor. Not just to return it. At some future date, he's going to be returning him a favor. Right now, you've been paid sort of. You've sort of been paid by that favor. Right now, the guy did you a favor and allowed you to take this keli. You were effectively paid using that, and at some future date, you'll pay him back by doing him a favor.
Right.
But right now, you're considered a shomer sachar. So when you're on the way there, then the fact that you're a shomer sachar is overshadowed by the fact that you're a shoyel. A shoyel has a stronger responsibility than a shomer sachar. When you're on your way back, the shoyel part has evaporated, because now you're not a shoyel anymore. You have no more rights to use the thing. Now you're only now what's left is only the shomer sachar. And a shomer sachar is potter for instance. So therefore, b'chazorah potter, b'peshu k'noyt sachar. So when it's on the way back, then he's potter, because then he's like a shomer sachar. So the point is, we see from the first part, where when he's taking them to his father-in-law's house, to his kala's house, that we say he's considered like a shoyel and he's chayiv and everything, that fits exactly with what Shmuel said, the same idea, where the person is taking the keli home to check it out. Okay, the Gemara tells a case in this connection. Ahu sapsira, there was a middleman. This middleman would buy from one person and sell to another. The shakol chamra lezavuni. He took a. Well, chamra can actually either be, can either be chamora a donkey or chamra wine. Either way, lezavuni to sell. V'lo yizban. He couldn't find anyone to buy it. Bahadi dehoder, as he was on his way back home to return it to the guy that he bought it from, itnis chamra, an accident happened, there was an onus. Chayver Rav Nachman, the Shalomi, and Rav Nachman obligated him to pay. Eisvei Rav Lo Rav Nachman, so Rav asked Rav Nachman, what do you mean? The braisa that we just said, Nansu b'halicha chayv, not the opposite, but Nansu b'halicha chayv b'chazorah potter. We said on the way, not opposite, I mean, if it happened on the way there, there's no question. Right, the chazorah, right. So the chazorah was saying he's potter, yeah. On Malay, so he says that this is different. Chazorah safsiro halachahi. When it comes to a middleman, when it comes to a merchant like that, even the returning is considered like going. The ilu mashk, he's responsible fully. The ilu mashkach was avuni, because if he were to find somebody just to sell to, afilo abava de besa, even if he, by the time he got back to the door of his own house, if he found somebody there who wants to buy this donkey or this wine, mila misabinle, wouldn't he sell it to him? So therefore, the whole time, until he actually returns it to the original owner, is considered effectively halacha. Whereas with the chassan? No, I mean, there's only, he took his kalim in order to give to his talis family. Once they turn them down, there's nobody else for him to give it to. So therefore, there's a difference between halacha and chazara, whereas with the sefsira, with this middleman over there, there's no such difference.
Wants to sell it, he can't sell it, he has no right to it.
Well, that's the point, right, the chassan, right, whereas the safsira is just supposed to be finding a customer, and wherever he finds a customer, then he's completed his shlichus at that point. That could even be on his way back. Okay. Mishnah says, okay, so just to summarize, as the Ran says, then the situation is we have to distinguish again between three different types of items for sale. Things that sell very easily, average things, and things that sell very slowly. Things that sell, so in the case where you said that you're not going to have hana from that you're not going to have hana from other Jews. So things that sell quickly, you can sell for their fair market value because you, the moicher, are not really getting any hana out of it. You could have easily found another buyer. Average things or slow selling things, you can't. Those things you have to sell at a discount. And with Shane Nanin Lee, that other people are not allowed to have enough for me, then it's the other way around. Where the other people are not allowed to have enough from you, then it's the other way around. If it's a slow selling thing, then the moicher has more of a hana. Even if it's sold for the fair market value, then the seller is the one who has the hana, and that's not what's also over here. Here is that the other people are not allowed to have hana. If you sell it to them at a discount, then it would be a problem because then they're having the hana. And if it's an average or fast selling thing, then they can't buy it at the regular price. They would have to buy it at an inflated price in order not to have hana. Mishnah says, "Konim shani nenel arelim." If somebody says a konim that I will not have hana from uncircumcised people, mutar ba'ar leYisrael. Wait, mutar ba'ar leYisrael. He's allowed to have hana from uncircumcised Jews, but also b'mulah erbikolim. But he's also to have hana from circumcised goyim, because even though physically they may be circumcised, la'alacha they're considered arelim. They're considered uncircumcised. And again, this is, I mentioned on Amud Aleph, that there's a machlokes that we're showing him over here. When we say Arle Yisrael, do we mean only what kind, or the other way around? Shani Nen Lemulim, when the mission continues, that if you make a neder not to have enough from people who are circumcised, also, but Arle Yisrael, you're still not allowed to have enough from uncircumcised Jews. They are considered Mulim, even though physically they're uncircumcised. You're allowed to have enough from all Goyim, even if they're circumcised. Again, he was where, this is what I was saying, that he was where you have machlokes. We're showing him what kind of Arli Yisrael are we talking about. Is it Davka, where they're oral under duress, because they're not able to have a bris milah because of health reasons? Or does it even include where they're not having a bris milah deliberately, because they don't believe in the mitzvah, or whatever? Right. Mishnah says, She'en orla kruya el l'shem erdik chavim. Because the term orla, It has more than just a physical meaning. It doesn't just mean the actual physical orla. It's a term for goyim. And again, when it says here, orla, it doesn't only mean idol worshippers. It means goyim in general. The Orla is a name that's given to Ovdi Kochavim. Shenemar, the pasuk says, Kichola Goyim Arelim. It says all the Goyim, all the nations are uncircumcised. B'chol Beis Yisrael, Arelev, and all the Jewish people are uncircumcised of heart, meaning like the Orla is a physical thing that covers over the Aver. Similarly, like the Jewish people have a covering over their heart that they're insensitive to what the Nevi'im are telling them. But we see from that, Kola Goyim Arelim, meaning even the ones who actually perform Bris Milah, they're still considered Arelim. Interesting thing, the Shagas Arya says on this, actually, I came across this yesterday in connection with the other shiur that I was preparing. He says, Takawai, I mean, for example, you have the B'nai Keturah, who the Gemara mentions in Sanhedrin, and the Rambam brings in Hilchos Malachim, that the B'nai Keturah are obligated in Bris Milah because they're descendants of Avraham Avinu.
You know?
No, so he says that, well, sort of, he says there is a difference between before and after Matan Torah. Matan Torah, there was an additional detail of Mila added, the mitzvah priya. Before Matan Torah, all you had, the original thing given to Avraham Avinu, we learned about this in Yevamos, is just Mila, is cutting the actual skin. Comes Matan Torah, and now you have the extra thing of priya, tearing the membrane over there. B'nai Keturah don't have that part of the mitzvah. Therefore, regardless of whether they actually do it or not, similar to what we said on Amud Aleph, it has to be mitzvah of oisus. They have the commandment and they actually do it. They don't have the mitzvah of kriya. As far as us Jews are concerned, the halacha is movale parak ilu leimul. If you do the milah without the kriya, it's not considered a milah at all. Therefore, yes, they can be considered arelim, even if physically they don't have an arla. Okay.
Priya.
Doesn't matter if that's the point the Shagas Arya is making, since they don't have the mitzvah of Priya. So from our point of view, it doesn't count. But Omer, and you have another pasuk. V'hoya plishti aral azeh, David HaMelech, before he fights Goliath, says that just like I defeated the lions and the bears and whatever, the same way this plishti, this uncircumcised plishti, will be like that as well. Omer, and then you have a third pasuk that David, part of David's kina after Shaul and Yonasan and Shaul's other children were killed in battle. That the he says don't tell about it in public. Pen tismachnam b'nois plishtim, and that the daughters of the plishtim should not be happy. Pen taloznam b'nois harelim, that the daughters of the uncircumcised shouldn't rejoice. So you see again that the goyim collectively are called harelim. So what he needs to be spoken for. So the Rambam says like this. The first pasuk just tells us, okay, when you say kol ha-goyim arelim, you don't mean literally that they're arelim. You mean like arelay from the Jewish people at the end of the pasuk. They're insensitive to messages of ruchnius. So therefore, we have the second pasuk about v'hoya plishtia oral azeh, that David. Now, what do you mean David is calling him an oral? Does he know what's actually under the guy's clothes? Maybe he taka has a bris milah. No, the fact that he called him an oral shows that goyim collectively can be called that a goy can be called an oral.
So,
and then he says what's the third pasuk? He says, okay, so you could argue fine, you know, it's uncommon that a goy is going to be circumcised. But what about, for example, I mean, you have a whole nation of plishtim. Inevitably, you're going to have some people who were born already circumcised. You have people who are born occasionally without a foreskin. It's called the Nolad Trumol, and an entire nation. But, and yet, no, we're not talking Shemayim, we're talking plishtim. We're talking plishtim. But even among the whole plishti nation, inevitably, there's not only one person who doesn't have a natural circumcision. But no, the fact that the pasuk says, Pental Lozna, Benoit Harelim, that David collectively calls them all Harelim, implies that even if they are physically circumcised, they're still considered Harelim. That's why you need to be circumcised, the guy says. Marsha says that.
So the second
pasuk teaches us that Harelim doesn't just mean metaphorically Harelim, it means literally Harelim.
Why do we need the second pasuk?
Because otherwise, from the first pasuk, we'd only know that it means metaphorically. We think that when it says that kol ha-goyim arelim doesn't mean that they're, we're considering them literally uncircumcised. We just consider they're insensitive to.
Why don't you say both for the first pasuk?
Okay, but that's how the Rambam learns. That's the point. If you only had the first pasuk, you wouldn't be sure of that. Yes, you might think. Marsha says differently. Marsha says like this. The first pasuk, fine. You say arelim plural, then fine. We can say that it means the goyim collectively. What if a person were to make a neder that I'm not going to have hana from this oral? Now, would that include what about if the person has a bris milah? What if the person has a bris milah circumcision, whatever? Then the second pasuk, a plishtia oral of that, teaches us that even an individual, even though he may well have a circumcision, is still considered an oral. So the first pasuk teaches us collectively. The second pasuk teaches us about individuals. And the third pasuk tells us, what about goyish women? When it comes to Jewish women, the Gemara mentions in Avodah Zarah, Isha Kaman Mehila Dami, a woman is considered as if she already has a bris milah. Therefore, a woman technically can perform a bris milah. We'll talk about it tomorrow in connection with Sipora and Moshe's baby. What about, does the same thing apply to Goyim? No, the fact that we're calling them Bnois Harelim implies that even they are considered Harelim. And therefore, again, according to Marsha, if we need all three psukim. Yeah. Okay. Now the Mishnah goes into a little bit of Agata. Rabbi Loza ben Azayim, Mu'usihi ha'orla shenis ganavar Rishoyim. The orla is a repulsive, disgusting thing that the Rishoyim are like made fun of using it. Shenema, pikol ha'goyim ha'relim. This pasuk that we just quoted, that all the goyim are uncircumcised. You see, it's used as like a term of disrespect, a term of a derogatory term, yeah. Rabbi Shmuel, G'doyla Mila shenichutza ala shloish eser brisis. Mila is a tremendously great mitzvah that 13 brisis were made over it. And in the parasha of Mila, in the parasha of Lech Lecha, in Perek Yudzayin, over there was 13 times it says the word bris. There's the famous maimer in Likud B'Torah that said usually at a Chabad bris, where the Alter Rebbe explains the deeper idea of these 13 brises. It's related to the Yud Gimel Midas Arachnim, and the idea is that Mila is beyond Shem Avaya, and the Yud Gimel Midas Arachnim are also beyond Shem Avaya, Vayav and Avaya Alponov. So therefore, that's the connection. Like Mila taps into something beyond even any name of Eivishter.
Did Mila after Matan Torah became even more chashuv than before Matan Torah, or was the same?
So the Rambam actually has an interesting thing. The Rambam mentions in Pirush Mishnayos and Chulin that you should know. He says any mitzvah that we keep nowadays is not because it was given to Avraham or Yaakov or whatever before Matan Torah. He mentioned it in connection with Gid Anosha. Don't think we don't need the Gid Anosha because of the pasuk in Vayishlach that Alkein Lo Yosef Menetzel is Gid Anosha. No, we don't need the Gid Anosha because the Eibishter, we gave that mitzvah at Matan Torah. So similarly with Mila, there is the fact that Eibishter gave it to Avraham Avinu, but the fact that we keep it is not so much because of that, but rather because the Eibishter, we gave it at Matan Torah. Yeah. Rabbi Yosi, Megdoyla Mila Shadoiches Shabbos Hamura. Rabbi Yosi says Mila is a great mitzvah. Yeah, that it overrides even Shabbos, also at the beginning of Yeramos. That it overrides Shabbos, which is a tremendously important mitzvah. And yes, you do a bris mila on Shabbos. Rabbi Yisro ben Kochai, Megdoyla Mila. We see how great Mila is. Shlo Nitlul Le Moshe Hatzadik Aleha Meloi Shah. We see that even Moshe, the great tzaddik, wasn't given, was not, his punishment was not suspended for even a short time for failure to do a bris milah. Yep. Namely, what we'll talk about in the Gemara at this point, we'll probably get to it tomorrow, the story over there when Moshe is on his way to Mitzrayim with his family, and Vayif Kesheu Hashem Vayivakash HaMisa, and then Tzipora realizes we have to do a bris milah for our son.
That was before Matan Torah,
even, yeah. So we see how great milah is, that even though Moshe is involved in tremendously important things, and he's a tzaddik, still, he wasn't even given a moment. Yeah. Reb Nechemiah, Megdola Mila Shadoches and Negoyim. Reb Nechemiah says Mila is a great thing that it overrides the dinim of Negoyim, of Tzaraas, that we know, we learned together also in Shabbos and in Yevamos, that if a person has a Tzaraas spot on his Orla, ordinarily there's an Issur in the Torah to chop off the monim of Tzaraas, but here, you cut it off. Now, the Marsha points out, I mean, if we mentioned Shabbos already, then what's Tzaraas compared to that? I mean, so Shabbos is an Issur Skila and Kores, Tzaraas is only an Issur Lav. The Marsha says the point is that the fact that it overrides Shabbos teaches us the importance of Mila Bismana. The fact that it overrides Tzaraas teaches us the importance even of Mila Shaloi Bismana. Because to override Shabbos, you can only do it with a bris mila on the eighth day. To override Tzaraas, you can do any kind. So therefore, Reb Nechemiah has to point that out also. Rebbe Yomer, G'doyla
Mila.
Rebbe Yomer, Meir Yomer says on the side, G'doyla Mila, Shekola Mitzvah Sha'asa Avraham Avinu, with all the mitzvahs that Avraham Avinu did, Lo Nikra Shalem Ad Shemol, he still was not considered whole until he actually had a bris mila. Shenema, he's Halek Bafanai Ve'ye Tavim, the Eivisha tells him, walk before me and be perfect. He's fine, that up until this point, he's not perfect. Dover Acher, another explanation, G'doyla Mila, She'il Mala Hila Bara HaKadosh Baruch Hu Etzel Lama, if not for Mila, the Eibishter would not have created the world in the first place. Shenema, Koyama Hashem, Im Loi Brisi Yevim V'Layla, if it were not for my bris that exists by day and by night, which means the bris Mila, it's the only mitzvah a person has with him 24-7. Famous story about Dover HaMelech in the bathhouse, that he's naked of all the mitzvahs, and he remembers that he has a bris Mila.
Brisi is also terrible.
Yeah, the Gemara is going to discuss tomorrow whether the pasuk is referring to Torah or Bris Mila. Yeah. Right now, the Mishnah is assuming that it means Bris Mila. Chukas, Shemayim Oretz, Lo Samti, then I would not have set up the rules of heaven and earth. And then the Ran brings, and it's also in Ein Yaakov, one more, Rebbe, G'dayla Mila, she's shkula k'neged kol ha-mitzvahs. Mila is a great thing, that it's considered equal to all the other mitzvahs. Shenema hine dama bris v'gayma, because we see before Matan Torah, at the end of Parashas Mishpatim, Moshe brings the Nare ben Yisrael bring karbonos, Moshe takes the blood and sprinkles it, and he says, hine dama bris, here is the blood of the covenant. So even though, okay, on the simple meaning, the blood we're talking about is the blood of the karbonos, nevertheless, we see there's an association between blood, between blood of bris, which includes also, therefore, the bris milah, and all the mitzvahs. It's a different kind of thing, but yeah. So therefore, since the whole Torah is called the bris, and milah is also called the bris, and we see there's an association between dam and bris, then there's that connection. Even though the dam over there was not really the dam of Mila, but rather the dam of Korbanos. Another Mephoshim we talk about, I mean, it's also, Moshe may have been referring back to the Mila that they had 7 weeks earlier before they left the giant. Yeah. Okay. We continue tomorrow, Bez.